to hear about the fairy-ishes, as you call them. But make haste. What's the matter? Get my horse, I say.
I'll see thee damned before I be their servant, growled the lad.
You'll see me what?
Asked Catherine in surprise. Damned, thou saucy witch, he replied.
There, Miss Cathy, you see you have got into pretty company, I interposed. Nice words to be used to a young lady. Pray don't begin to dispute with him. Come, let us seek for Minnie ourselves and be gone.
But Ellen,
cried she, staring fixed in astonishment.
How dare he speak so to me? Mustn't he be made to do as I ask him? You wicked creature, I shall tell Papa what you said. Now then.
Hareton did not appear to feel this threat, so the tears sprang into her eyes with indignation.
You bring the pony,
she exclaimed, turning to the woman.
And let my dog free this moment.
Softly, miss, answered she addressed. You'll lose nothing by being civil. Though Mr. Hareton there be not the master's son, he's your cousin, and I was never hired to serve you.
He's my cousin,
cried Cathy with a scornful laugh.
Yes, indeed,
responded her reprover.
Oh, Ellen, don't let them say such things,
she pursued in great trouble.
Papa is gone to fetch my cousin from London. My cousin is a gentleman's son. That, my...
She stopped and wept outright, upset at the bare notion of a relationship with such a clown.
Hush, hush, I whispered. People can have many cousins and of all sorts, Miss Cathy, without being any the worse for it, only they needn't keep their company if they be disagreeable and bad.
He's not my cousin, Ellen,
she went on, gathering fresh grief from reflection and flinging herself into my arms for refuge from the idea. I was much vexed at her and the servant for their mutual revelations, having no doubt of Linton's approaching arrival, communicated by the former being reported to Mr. Heathcliff, and feeling as confident that Catherine's first thought on her father's return would be to seek an explanation of the latter's assertion concerning her rude-bred kindred. Hareton, recovering from his disgust at being taken for a servant, seemed moved by her distress, and having fetched the pony round to the door, he took, to propitiate her, a fine crooked-legged terrier whelp from the kennel, and putting it into her hand, bid her whist, for he meant naught. Pausing in her lamentations, she surveyed him with a glance of awe and horror, then burst forth anew. I could scarcely refrain from smiling at this antipathy to the poor fellow, who was a well-made athletic youth, good-looking in features, and stout and healthy, but attired in garments befitting his daily occupations of working on the farm and lounging among the moors after rabbits and game. Still, I thought I could detect in his physiognomy a mind owning better qualities than his father ever possessed. Good things lost amid a wilderness of weeds, to be sure, whose rankness far overtopped their neglected growth, yet notwithstanding, evidence of a wealthy soil that might yield luxuriant crops under other and favourable circumstances. Mr. Heathcliff, I believe, had not treated him physically ill, thanks to his fearless nature, which offered no temptation to that course of oppression. He had none of the timid susceptibility that would have given zest to ill-treatment in Heathcliff's judgment. He appeared to have bent his malevolence on making him a brute. He was never taught to read or write, never rebuked for any bad habit which did not annoy his keeper, never led a single step towards virtue, or guarded by a single precept against vice. And from what I heard, Joseph contributed much to his deterioration by a narrow-minded partiality which prompted him to flatter and pet him as a boy, because he was the head of the old family. And as he had been in the habit of accusing Catherine Earnshaw and Heathcliff, when children, of putting the master past his patience and compelling him to seek solace in drink by what he termed their offald ways, so at present he laid the whole burden of Hareton's faults on the shoulders of the usurper of his property. If the lad swore he wouldn't correct him, nor however culpably he behaved, it gave Joseph satisfaction, apparently, to watch him go the worst lengths. He allowed that the lad was ruined, that his soul was abandoned to perdition, but then he reflected that Heathcliff must answer for it. Hareton's blood would be required at his hands, and there lay immense consolation in that thought. Joseph had instilled into him a pride of name and of his lineage. He would, had he dared, have fostered hate between him and the present owner of the heights, but his dread of that owner amounted to superstition, and he confined his feelings regarding him to muttered innuendos and private comminations. I don't pretend to be intimately acquainted with the mode of living customary in those days at Wuthering Heights. I only speak from hearsay, for I saw little. The villagers affirmed Mr. Heathcliff was near, and a cruel, hard landlord to his tenants, but the house inside had regained its ancient aspect of comfort under female management, and the scenes of riot common in Hindley's time were not now enacted within its walls. The master was too gloomy to seek companionship with any people, good or bad, and he is yet. This, however, is not making progress with my story. Miss Cathy rejected the peace offering of the terrier and demanded her own dogs, Charlie and Phoenix. They came limping and hanging their heads, and we set out for home, sadly out of sorts, every one of us. I could not wring from my little lady how she had spent the day, except that, as I supposed, the goal of her pilgrimage was Penistone Crags, and she arrived without adventure to the gate of the farmhouse, when Hareton happened to issue forth, attended by some canine followers who attacked her train. They had a smart battle before their owners could separate them. That formed an introduction. Catherine told Hareton who she was and where she was going, and asked him to show her the way, finally beguiling him to accompany her. He opened the mysteries of the fairy cave and 20 other queer places, but being in disgrace, I was not favoured with a description of the interesting objects she saw. I could gather, however, that her guide had been a favourite till she hurt his feelings by addressing him as a servant, and Heathcliff's housekeeper hurt hers by calling him her cousin. Then the language he had held to her rankled in her heart. She, who was always love and darling and queen and angel, with everybody at the Grange, to be insulted so shockingly by a stranger. She did not comprehend it. And hard work I had to obtain a promise that she would not lay the grievance before her father. I explained how he objected to the whole household at the Heights, and how sorry he would be to find she had been there. But I insisted most on the fact that if she revealed any negligence of his orders, he would perhaps be so angry that I should have to leave, and Cathy couldn't bear that prospect. She pledged her word and kept it for my sake. After all, she was a sweet little girl. Chapter 19. A letter edged with black announced the day of my master's return. Isabella was dead, and he wrote to bid me get mourning for his daughter and arrange a room and other accommodations for his youthful nephew. Catherine ran wild with joy at the idea of welcoming her father back, and indulged most sanguine anticipations of the innumerable excellencies of her real cousin. The evening of their expected arrival came. Since early morning she had been busy ordering her own small affairs, and now attired in her new black frock, poor thing. Her aunt's death impressed her with no definite sorrow. She obliged me by constant worrying to walk with her down through the grounds to meet them. "Linton is just 6 months younger than I am," she chattered as we strolled leisurely over the swells and hollows of mossy turf under shadow of the trees. "How delightful it would be to have him for a playfellow. Aunt Isabella sent Papa a beautiful lock of his hair. It was lighter than mine, more flaxen, and quite as fine. I have it carefully preserved in a little glass box, and I've often thought what a pleasure it would be to see its owner. Oh, I am happy. And Papa, dear, dear Papa. Come, Ellen, let us run. Come, run." She ran and returned and ran again, many times before my sober footsteps reached the gate. And then she seated herself on the grassy bank beside the path and tried to wait patiently. But that was impossible. She couldn't be still a minute. "How long are they?" she exclaimed. "Ah, I see some dust on the road. They are coming." "No. When will they be here? May we not go a little way? Half a mile, Ellen.
only just half a mile. Do say yes. To that clump of birches at the turn.
I refused staunchly. At length her suspense was ended. The travelling carriage rolled in sight. Miss Cathy shrieked and stretched out her arms as soon as she caught her father's face looking from the window. He descended nearly as eager as herself, and a considerable interval elapsed ere they had a thought to spare for any but themselves. While they exchanged caresses, I took a peep in to see after Linton. He was asleep in a corner, wrapped in a warm fur-lined cloak, as if it had been winter. A pale, delicate, effeminate boy, who might have been taken for my master's younger brother. So strong was the resemblance. But there was a sickly peevishness in his aspect that Edgar Linton never had. The latter saw me looking, and having shaken hands advised me to close the door and leave him undisturbed, for the journey had fatigued him. Cathy would fain have taken one glance, but her father told her to come, and they walked together up the park, while I hastened before to prepare the servants. "Now, darling," said Mr. Linton, addressing his daughter, as they halted at the bottom of the front steps. "Your cousin is not so strong or so merry as you are, and he has lost his mother, remember, a very short time since. Therefore, don't expect him to play and run about with you directly, and don't harass him much by talking. Let him be quiet this evening at least, will you?"
"Yes, yes, Papa," answered Catherine. "But I do want to see him, and he hasn't once looked out."
The carriage stopped, and the sleeper being roused was lifted to the ground by his uncle. "This is your cousin," he said, putting their little hands together. "She's fond of you already, and mind you don't grieve her by crying tonight. Try to be cheerful now. The travelling is at an end, and you have nothing to do but rest and amuse yourself as you please."
"Let me go to bed, then,"
answered the boy, shrinking from Catherine's salute, and he put his fingers to remove incipient tears.
"Come, come, there's a good child," I whispered, leading him in. "You'll make her weep too. See how sorry she is for you."
I do not know whether it was sorrow for him, but his cousin put on as sad a countenance as himself, and returned to her father. All three entered and mounted to the library, where tea was laid ready. I proceeded to remove Linton's cap and mantle, and placed him on a chair by the table, but he was no sooner seated than he began to cry afresh. My master inquired what was the matter.
"I can't sit on a chair,"
sobbed the boy. "Go to the sofa, then, and Ellen shall bring you some tea," answered his uncle patiently. He had been greatly tired during the journey, I felt convinced by his fretful ailing charge. Linton slowly trailed himself off and lay down. Cathy carried a footstool and her cup to his side. At first she sat silent, but that could not last. She had resolved to make a pet of her little cousin, as she would have him to be, and she commenced stroking his curls and kissing his cheek and offering him tea in a saucer like a baby. This pleased him, for he was not much better. He dried his eyes and lightened into a faint smile. "Oh, he'll do very well," said the master to me, after watching them a minute. "Very well, if we can keep him, Ellen. The company of a child his own age will instill new spirit into him soon, and by wishing for strength he'll gain it." "Aye, if we can keep him," I mused to myself, and sore misgivings came over me that there was slight hope of that. And then I thought, however will that weakling live at Wuthering Heights? Between his father and Hareton, what playmates and instructors they'll be. Our doubts were presently decided, even earlier than I expected. I had just taken the children upstairs after tea was finished and seen Linton asleep. He would not suffer me to leave him till that was the case. I had come down and was standing by the table in the hall, lighting a bedroom candle for Mr. Edgar, when a maid stepped out of the kitchen and informed me that Mr. Heathcliff's servant Joseph was at the door and wished to speak with the master.
"I shall ask him what he wants first," I said in considerable trepidation. "A very unlikely hour to be troubling people, and the instant they have returned from a long journey. I don't think the master can see him."
Joseph had advanced through the kitchen as I uttered these words, and now presented himself in the hall. He was donned in his Sunday garments, with his most sanctimonious and sourest face, and holding his hat in one hand and his stick in the other, he proceeded to clean his shoes on the mat. "Good evening, Joseph," I said coldly. "What business brings you here tonight?"
"It's Master Linton I'm on, Spectre,"
he answered, waving me disdainfully aside.
"Mr. Linton is going to bed. Unless you have something particular to say, I'm sure he won't hear it now," I continued. "You had better sit down in there and entrust your message to me."
"Which is his ram?"
pursued the fellow, surveying the range of closed doors. Very reluctantly, I went up to the library and announced the unseasonable visitor, advising that he should be dismissed till next day. Mr. Linton had no time to empower me to do so, for Joseph mounted close at my heels, and pushing into the apartment, planted himself at the far side of the table, with his two fists clapped on the head of his stick, and began in an elevated tone as if anticipating opposition.
"Heathcliff has sent me for his lad, and I mun't go back about him."
Edgar Linton was silent a minute, an expression of exceeding sorrow overcast his features. He would have pitied the child on his own account, but recalling Isabella's hopes and fears and anxious wishes for her son, and her commendations of him to his care, he grieved bitterly at the prospect of yielding him up, and searched in his heart how it might be avoided. No plan offered itself. The very exhibition of any desire to keep him would have rendered the claimant more peremptory. There was nothing left but to resign him. However, he was not going to rouse him from his sleep.
"Tell Mr. Heathcliff,"
he answered calmly,
"that his son shall come to Wuthering Heights tomorrow. He is in bed and too tired to go the distance now. You may also tell him that the mother of Linton desired him to remain under my guardianship, and at present his health is very precarious."
"No,"
said Joseph, giving a thud with his prop on the floor and assuming an authoritative air.
"No, that means not. Heathcliff makes no count at mother, nor ye norther. But he'll hae his lad, and I mun take him, so now you know."
"You shall not tonight,"
answered Linton decisively.
"Walk downstairs at once and repeat to your master what I have said. Ellen, show him down. Go."
And, aiding the indignant elder with a lift by the arm, he rid the room of him and closed the door.
"Farewell,"
shouted Joseph as he slowly drew off.
"To morn is come his cell, and thrust him out if you dare."
Chapter 20. To obviate the danger of this threat being fulfilled, Mr. Linton commissioned me to take the boy home early, on Catherine's pony. And said he,
"As we shall now have no influence over his destiny, good or bad, you must say nothing of where he is gone to my daughter. She cannot associate with him hereafter, and it is better for her to remain in ignorance of his proximity, lest she should be restless and anxious to visit the heights. Merely tell her his father sent for him suddenly, and he has been obliged to leave us." Linton was very reluctant to be roused from his bed at 5 o'clock, and astonished to be informed that he must prepare for further travelling, but I softened off the matter by stating that he was going to spend some time with his father, Mr. Heathcliff, who wished to see him so much he did not like to defer the pleasure till he should recover from his late journey.
"My father?"
he cried in strange perplexity.
"Mama never told me I had a father. Where does he live? I'd rather stay with my uncle."
"He lives a little distance from the Grange," I replied. "Just beyond those hills, not so far, but you may walk over here when you get hearty. And you should be glad to go home and see him. You must try to love him, as you did your mother, and then he will love you."
"But why have I not heard of him before?"
asked Linton.
"Why didn't Mama and he live together as other people do?"
"He had business to keep him in the north," I answered, "and your mother's health required her to reside in the south."
"And why didn't Mama speak to me about him?"
persevered the child.
She often talked of Uncle, and I learnt to love him long ago. How am I to love Papa? I don't know him.
Oh, all children love their parents, I said. Your mother perhaps thought you would want to be with him if she mentioned him often to you. Let us make haste. An early ride on such a beautiful morning is much preferable to an hour's more sleep.
Is she to go with us?
He demanded.
The little girl I saw yesterday?
Not now, replied I.
Is Uncle?
He continued. No, I shall be your companion there, I said. Linton sank back on his pillow and fell into a brown study.
I won't go without Uncle,
he cried at length.
I can't tell where you mean to take me.
I attempted to persuade him of the naughtiness of showing reluctance to meet his father. Still, he obstinately resisted any progress towards dressing, and I had to call for my master's assistance in coaxing him out of bed. The poor thing was finally got off, with several delusive assurances that his absence would be short, that Mr. Edgar and Cathy would visit him, and other promises equally ill-founded, which I invented and reiterated at intervals throughout the way. The pure heather-scented air, the bright sunshine, and the gentle canter of Minnie relieved his despondency after a while. He began to put questions concerning his new home and its inhabitants with greater interest and liveliness.
"Is Wuthering Heights as pleasant a place as Thrushcross Grange?"
he inquired, turning to take a last glance into the valley, whence a light mist mounted and formed a fleecy cloud on the skirts of the blue. "It is not so buried in trees," I replied, "and it is not quite so large, but you can see the country beautifully all round, and the air is healthier for you, fresher and drier. You will perhaps think the building old and dark at first, though it is a respectable house, the next best in the neighbourhood, and you will have such nice rambles on the moors. Hareton Earnshaw, that is Miss Cathy's other cousin, and so yours in a manner, will show you all the sweetest spots, and you can bring a book in fine weather, and make a green hollow your study, and now and then your uncle may join you in a walk. He does frequently walk out on the hills."
"And what is my father like?"
he asked.
"Is he as young and handsome as Uncle?"
"He's as young," said I, "but he has black hair and eyes and looks sterner, and he is taller and bigger altogether. He'll not seem to you so gentle and kind at first, perhaps, because it is not his way. Still, mind you, be frank and cordial with him, and naturally he'll be fonder of you than any uncle, for you are his own."
"Black hair and eyes," mused Linton. "I can't fancy him. Then I am not like him, am I?"
"Not much," I answered. Not a morsel, I thought, surveying with regret the white complexion and slim frame of my companion, and his large, languid eyes, his mother's eyes, save that, unless a morbid touchiness kindled them a moment, they had not a vestige of her sparkling spirit.
"How strange that he should never come to see Mama and me," he murmured. "Has he ever seen me? If he has, I must have been a baby. I remember not a single thing about him."
"Why, Master Linton," said I, 300 miles is a great distance, and 10 years seems very different in length to a grown-up person compared with what they do to you. It is probable Mr. Heathcliff proposed going from summer to summer, but never found a convenient opportunity, and now it is too late. Don't trouble him with questions on the subject. It will disturb him for no good." The boy was fully occupied with his own cogitations for the remainder of the ride, till we halted before the farmhouse garden gate. I watched to catch his impressions on his countenance. He surveyed the carved front and low-browed lattices, the straggling gooseberry bushes and crooked firs, with solemn intentness, and then shook his head, his private feelings entirely disapproved of the exterior of his new abode. But he had sense to postpone complaining. There might be compensation within. Before he dismounted, I went and opened the door. It was 6:30. The family had just finished breakfast. The servant was clearing and wiping down the table.
Joseph stood by his master's chair telling some tale concerning a lame horse, and Hareton was preparing for the hayfield.
"Hello, Nelly," said Mr. Heathcliff when he saw me. "I feared I should have to come down and fetch my property myself. You've brought it, have you? Let us see what we can make of it."
He got up and strode to the door. Hareton and Joseph followed in gaping curiosity. Poor Linton ran a frightened eye over the faces of the three.
"Surely,"
said Joseph after a grave inspection.
"It's what we ye, master, and yon's his lass."
Heathcliff, having stirred his son into an ague of confusion, uttered a scornful laugh.
"God, what a beauty. What a lovely, charming thing," he exclaimed. "Haven't they reared it on snails and sour milk, Nelly? Oh, damn my soul. But that's worse than I expected. And the devil knows I was not sanguine."
I bid the trembling and bewildered child get down and enter. He did not thoroughly comprehend the meaning of his father's speech, or whether it were intended for him. Indeed, he was not yet certain that the grim, sneering stranger was his father. But he clung to me with growing trepidation, and on Mr. Heathcliff's taking a seat and bidding him, "Come hither," he hid his face on my shoulder and wept. Said Heathcliff, stretching out a hand and dragging him roughly between his knees and then holding up his head by the chin.
"None of that nonsense. We're not going to hurt thee, Linton. Isn't that thy name? Thou art thy mother's child entirely. Where is my share in thee, pulling chicken?"
He took off the boy's cap and pushed back his thick flaxen curls, felt his slender arms and his small fingers, during which examination Linton ceased crying and lifted his great blue eyes to inspect the inspector.
"Do you know me?"
asked Heathcliff, having satisfied himself that the limbs were all equally frail and feeble.
"No,"
said Linton, with a gaze of vacant fear.
"You've heard of me, I dare say."
"No," he replied again.
"No? What a shame of your mother never to waken your filial regard for me. You are my son, then, I tell you, and your mother was a wicked slut to leave you in ignorance of the sort of father you possessed. Now don't wince and colour up, though it is something to see you have not white blood. Be a good lad and I'll do for you. Nelly, if you be tired you may sit down, if not get home again. I guess you'll report what you hear and see to the cipher at the Grange, and this thing won't be settled while you linger about it."
"Well," replied I hope you'll be kind to the boy, Mr. Heathcliff, or you'll not keep him long, and he's all that you have akin in the wide world that you will ever know, remember."
"I'll be very kind to him, you needn't fear,"
he said, laughing.
"Only nobody else must be kind to him. I'm jealous of monopolizing his affection. And to begin my kindness, Joseph, bring the lad some breakfast. Hareton, you infernal calf, be gone to your work. Yes, Nell," he added, when they had departed. "My son is prospective owner of your place, and I should not wish him to die until I was certain of being his successor. Besides, he's mine, and I want the triumph of seeing my descendant fairly lord of their estates. My child hiring their children to till their father's lands for wages. That is the sole consideration which can make me endure the whelp. I despise him for himself and hate him for the memories he revives. But that consideration is sufficient. He's as safe with me and shall be tended as carefully as your master tends his own. I have a room upstairs furnished for him, in handsome style. I've engaged a tutor also to come 3 times a week, from 20 miles distance, to teach him what he pleases to learn. I've ordered Hareton to obey him, and in fact I've arranged everything with a view to preserve the superior and the gentleman in him, above his associates. I do regret, however, that he so little deserves the trouble. If I wished any blessing in the world, it was to find him a worthy object of pride, and I'm bitterly disappointed with the whey-faced, whining wretch."
While he was speaking, Joseph returned bearing a basin of milk porridge and placed it before Linton,
who stirred round the homely mess with a look of aversion, and affirmed he could not eat it. I saw the old manservant shared largely in his master's scorn of the child, though he was compelled to retain the sentiment in his heart, because Heathcliff plainly meant his underlings to hold him in honour.
"Cannot eat it," repeated he, peering in Linton's face and subduing his voice to a whisper for fear of being overheard. "But Master Hareton never ate nought else, when he were a little un, and what were good enough for him's good enough for ye, I's rather think."
"I shan't eat it," answered Linton snappishly. "Take it away."
Joseph snatched up the food indignantly and brought it to us.
"Is there aught ails victuals?"
he asked, thrusting the tray under Heathcliff's nose. "What should ail them?" he said.
"Why," answered Joseph, "yon dainty chap says he cannot eat him, but I guess it's right. His mother were just so. We were almost too mucky to soak corn for making her bread." "Don't mention his mother to me," said the master angrily. "Get him something he can eat, that's all."
"What is his usual food, Nelly?" I suggested boiled milk or tea, and the housekeeper received instructions to prepare some. Come, I reflected, his father's selfishness may contribute to his comfort. He perceives his delicate constitution and the necessity of treating him tolerably. I'll console Mr. Edgar by acquainting him with the turn Heathcliff's humour has taken. Having no excuse for lingering longer, I slipped out while Linton was engaged in timidly rebuffing the advances of a friendly sheepdog. But he was too much on the alert to be cheated. As I closed the door, I heard a cry, and a frantic repetition of the words,
"Don't leave me! I'll not stay here! I'll not stay here!"
Then the latch was raised and fell. They did not suffer him to come forth. I mounted Minnie and urged her to a trot, and so my brief guardianship ended. Chapter 21. We had sad work with little Cathy that day. She rose in high glee, eager to join her cousin, and such passionate tears and lamentations followed the news of his departure that Edgar himself was obliged to soothe her by affirming he should come back soon. He added, however, "If I can get him." And there were no hopes of that. This promise poorly pacified her, but time was more potent, and though still at interval she inquired of her father when Linton would return, before she did see him again his features had waxed so dim in her memory that she did not recognise him. When I chanced to encounter the housekeeper of Wuthering Heights in paying business visits to Gimmerton, I used to ask how the young master got on, for he lived almost as secluded as Catherine herself and was never to be seen. I could gather from her that he continued in weak health and was a tiresome inmate. She said Mr. Heathcliff seemed to dislike him ever longer and worse, though he took some trouble to conceal it. He had an antipathy to the sound of his voice, and could not do at all with his sitting in the same room with him many minutes together. There seldom passed much talk between them. Linton learnt his lessons and spent his evenings in a small apartment they called the parlour, or else lay in bed all day, for he was constantly getting coughs and colds and aches and pains of some sort. "And I never know such a faint-hearted creature," added the woman. "Nor one so careful of hissel. He will go on if I leave the window open a bit late in evening. Oh, it's killing, it's a breath of night air. And he must have a fire in the middle of summer, and Joseph's backer-pipe is poison, and he must always have sweets and dainties, and always milk, milk forever. He didn't not our rest of us are pinched in winter. And there he'll sit, wrapped in his furred cloak in his chair by the fire, with some toast or water or other slop on the hob to sip at. And if Hareton, for pity, comes to amuse him, Hareton is not bad-natured, though he's rough. They're short apart, one swearing and the other crying. I believe the master would relish Earnshaw's thrashing him to a mummy, if he were not his son, and I'm certain he would be fit to turn him out of doors if he knew half the nursing he gives hissel. But then he won't go into danger of temptation. He never enters the parlour, and should Linton show those ways in the house where he is, he sends him upstairs directly." I divined from this account that utter lack of sympathy had rendered young Heathcliff selfish and disagreeable, if he were not so originally, and my interest in him consequently decayed.
Though still, I was moved with a sense of grief at his lot and a wish that he had been left with us. Mr. Edgar encouraged me to gain information. He thought a great deal about him, I fancy, and would have run some risk to see him. And he told me once to ask the housekeeper whether he ever came into the village. She said he had only been twice, on horseback, accompanying his father, and both times he pretended to be quite knocked up for 3 or 4 days afterwards. That housekeeper left, if I recollect rightly, 2 years after he came, and another whom I did not know was her successor. She lives there still. Time wore on at the Grange in its former pleasant way till Miss Cathy reached 16. On the anniversary of her birth, we never manifested any signs of rejoicing, because it was also the anniversary of my late mistress's death. Her father invariably spent that day alone in the library and walked at dusk as far as Gimmerton Kirkyard, where he would frequently prolong his stay beyond midnight. Therefore, Catherine was thrown on her own resources for amusement. This 20th of March was a beautiful spring day, and when her father had retired, my young lady came down dressed for going out, and said she asked to have a ramble on the edge of the moor with me. Mr. Linton had given her leave if we went only a short distance and were back within the hour.
"So make haste, Ellen," she cried.
"I know where I wish to go, where a colony of moor game are settled. I want to see whether they have made their nests yet." "That must be a good distance up," I answered. "They don't breed on the edge of the moor." "No, it's not," she said. "I've gone very near with Papa." I put on my bonnet and sailed out, thinking nothing more of the matter. She bounded before me and returned to my side and was off again like a young greyhound, and at first I found plenty of entertainment in listening to the larks singing far and near and enjoying the sweet warm sunshine, and watching her, my pet and my delight, with her golden ringlets flying loose behind, and her bright cheek, as soft and pure in its bloom as a wild rose, and her eyes radiant with cloudless pleasure. She was a happy creature, and an angel in those days. It's a pity she could not be content. "Well," said I, "where are your moor game, Miss Cathy? We should be at them. The Grange Park fence is a great way off now." "Oh, a little further, only a little further, Ellen," was her answer continually. "Climb to that hillock, past that bank, and by the time you reach the other side, I shall have raised the birds." But there were so many hillocks and banks to climb and pass that at length I began to be weary and told her we must halt and retrace our steps. I shouted to her as she had outstripped me a long way. She either did not hear or did not regard, for she still sprang on and I was compelled to follow. Finally, she dived into a hollow, and before I came in sight of her again, she was 2 miles nearer Wuthering Heights than her own home, and I beheld a couple of persons arrest her, one of whom I felt convinced was Mr. Heathcliff himself. Cathy had been caught in the fact of plundering, or at least hunting out the nests of the grouse. The heights were Heathcliff's land, and he was reproving the poacher. "I've neither taken nor found any," she said, as I toiled to them, expanding her hands in corroboration of the statement. "I didn't mean to take them, but Papa told me there were quantities up here, and I wished to see the eggs." Heathcliff glanced at me with an ill-meaning smile, expressing his acquaintance with the party, and consequently his malevolence towards it, and demanded who Papa was.
"Mr. Linton of Thrushcross Grange," she replied. "I thought you did not know me, or you wouldn't have spoken in that way."
"You suppose Papa is highly esteemed and respected, then?" he said sarcastically.
"And what are you?"
inquired Catherine, gazing curiously on the speaker.
"That man I've seen before. Is he your son?"
She pointed to Hareton, the other individual, who had gained nothing but increased bulk and strength by the addition of 2 years to his age. He seemed as awkward and as rough as ever.
"Miss Cathy," I interrupted, "it will be 3 hours instead of one that we are out presently. We really must go back."
"No, that man is not my son," answered Heathcliff, pushing me aside. "But I have one, and you have seen him before too. And though your nurse is in a hurry, I think both you
and she would be the better for a little rest.
Will you just turn this knab of heath and walk into my house? You'll get home earlier for the ease, and you shall receive a kind welcome.
I whispered Catherine that she mustn't, on any account, accede to the proposal. It was entirely out of the question.
Why? She asked aloud. I'm tired of running and the ground is dewy. I can't sit here.
Let us go, Ellen. Besides, he says I have seen his son. He's mistaken, I think, but I guess where he lives, at the farmhouse I visited in coming from Penistone Crags. Don't you?
I do. Come, Nelly, hold your tongue. It will be a treat for her to look in on us. Hareton, get forward with the lass. You shall walk with me, Nelly.
No, she's not going to any such place,
I cried, struggling to release my arm, which he had seized. But she was almost at the doorstones already, scampering round the brow at full speed. Her appointed companion did not pretend to escort her. He shied off by the roadside and vanished.
Mr. Heathcliff, it's very wrong, I continued. You know you mean no good, and there she'll see Linton, and all will be told as soon as ever we return, and I shall have the blame.
I want her to see Linton, he answered. He's looking better these few days. It's not often he's fit to be seen, and we'll soon persuade her to keep the visit secret. Where is the harm of it?
The harm of it is that her father would hate me if he found I suffered her to enter your house, and I am convinced you have a bad design in encouraging her to do so, I replied.
My design is as honest as possible. I'll inform you of its whole scope, he said. That the two cousins may fall in love and get married. I'm acting generously to your master. His young chit has no expectations, and should she second my wishes, she'll be provided for at once as joint successor with Linton.
If Linton died, I answered, and his life is quite uncertain, Catherine would be the heir.
No, she would not, he said. There is no clause in the will to secure it, so his property would go to me, but to prevent disputes, I desire their union, and am resolved to bring it about.
And I am resolved she shall never approach your house with me again, I returned as we reached the gate where Miss Cathy waited our coming. Heathcliff bade me be quiet, and proceeding up the path, hastened to open the door. My young lady gave him several looks, as if she could not exactly make up her mind what to think of him. But now he smiled when he met her eye, and softened his voice in addressing her, and I was foolish enough to imagine the memory of her mother might disarm him from desiring her injury. Linton stood on the hearth. He had been out walking in the fields, for his cap was on, and he was calling to Joseph to bring him dry shoes. He had grown tall for his age, still wanting some months of 16. His features were pretty yet, and his eye and complexion brighter than I remembered them, though with merely temporary lustre borrowed from the salubrious air and genial sun.
"Now who is that?" asked Heathcliff, turning to Cathy. "Can you tell?"
"Your son," she said, having doubtfully surveyed first one and then the other.
"Yes, yes," answered he. "But is this the only time you have beheld him? Think." "Ah, you have a short memory. Linton, don't you recall your cousin, that you used to tease us so with wishing to see?"
"What? Linton?" cried Cathy, kindling into joyful surprise at the name. "Is that little Linton? He's taller than I am. Are you Linton?"
The youth stepped forward and acknowledged himself. She kissed him fervently, and they gazed with wonder at the change time had wrought in the appearance of each. Catherine had reached her full height. Her figure was both plump and slender, elastic as steel, and her whole aspect sparkling with health and spirits. Linton's looks and movements were very languid, and his form extremely slight, but there was a grace in his manner that mitigated these defects, and rendered him not unpleasing. After exchanging numerous marks of fondness with him, his cousin went to Mr. Heathcliff, who lingered by the door, dividing his attention between the objects inside and those that lay without, pretending, that is, to observe the latter, and really noting the former alone. And you are my uncle, then? She cried, reaching up to salute him. I thought I liked you, though you were cross at first. Why don't you visit at the Grange with Linton? To live all these years such close neighbours and never see us is odd. What have you done so for?
I visited it once or twice too often before you were born, he answered.
There, damn it. If you have any kisses to spare, give them to Linton. They are thrown away on me.
Naughty Ellen, exclaimed Catherine, flying to attack me next with her lavish caresses.
Wicked Ellen, to try to hinder me from entering. But I'll take this walk every morning in future. May I, Uncle? And sometimes bring Papa. Won't you be glad to see us?
Of course, replied the uncle, with a hardly suppressed grimace resulting from his deep aversion to both the proposed visitors. But stay, he continued, turning toward the young lady. Now I think of it, I'd better tell you. Mr. Linton has a prejudice against me. We quarrelled at one time of our lives with unchristian ferocity. And if you mention coming here to him, he'll put a veto on your visits altogether. Therefore, you must not mention it. Unless you be careless of seeing your cousin hereafter. You may come, if you will, but you must not mention it.
Why did you quarrel? Asked Catherine, considerably crestfallen.
He thought me too poor to wed his sister, answered Heathcliff, and was grieved that I got her. His pride was hurt, and he'll never forgive it.
That's wrong, said the young lady. Sometime I'll tell him so. But Linton and I have no share in your quarrel. I'll not come here then. He shall come to the Grange.
It will be too far for me, murmured her cousin. To walk 4 miles would kill me.
No, come here, Miss Catherine, now and then. Not every morning, but once or twice a week.
The father launched towards his son a glance of bitter contempt. I am afraid, Nelly, I shall lose my labour, he muttered to me. Miss Catherine, as the ninny calls her, will discover his value and send him to the devil. Now, if it had been Hareton, do you know that 20 times a day I covet Hareton with all his degradation? I'd have loved the lad had he been someone else. But I think he's safe from her love. I'll pit him against that paltry creature, unless it bestir itself briskly. We calculate it will scarcely last till it is 18. Oh, confound the vapid thing. He's absorbed in drying his feet and never looks at her. Linton!
Yes, father,
answered the boy. Have you nothing to show your cousin anywhere about? Not even a rabbit or a weasel's nest? Take her into the garden, before you change your shoes, and into the stable to see your horse.
Wouldn't you rather sit here?
Asked Linton, addressing Cathy in a tone which expressed reluctance to move again.
I don't know,
she replied, casting a longing look to the door and evidently eager to be active. He kept his seat and shrank closer to the fire. Heathcliff rose and went into the kitchen, and from thence to the yard, calling out for Hareton. Hareton responded, and presently the two re-entered. The young man had been washing himself, as was visible by the glow on his cheeks and his wetted hair.
Oh, I'll ask you, Uncle,
cried Miss Cathy, recollecting the housekeeper's assertion.
That is not my cousin, is he?
Yes, he replied. Your mother's nephew. Don't you like him? Catherine looked queer. Is he not a handsome lad? He continued. The uncivil little thing stood on tiptoe and whispered a sentence in Heathcliff's ear. He laughed, Hareton darkened. I perceived he was very sensitive to suspected slights, and had obviously a dim notion of his inferiority. But his master or guardian chased the frown by exclaiming,
You'll be the favourite among us, Hareton. She says you are a... what was it? Well, something very flattering. Here, you go with her round the farm, and behave like a gentleman, mind. Don't use any bad words, and don't stare when the young lady is not looking at you. And be ready to hide your face when she is. And when you speak, say your words slowly, and keep your hands out of your pockets. Be off and entertain her as nicely as you can.
He watched the couple walking past the window. Earnshaw had his countenance completely averted from his companion.
He seemed studying the familiar landscape with a stranger's and an artist's interest. Catherine took a sly look at him, expressing small admiration. She then turned her attention to seeking out objects of amusement for herself, and tripped merrily on, lilting a tune to supply the lack of conversation.
"I've tied his tongue," observed Heathcliff. "He'll not venture a single syllable all the time. Nelly, you recollect me at his age? Nay, some years younger. Did I ever look so stupid, so gormless, as Joseph calls it?"
"Worse," I replied. "Because more sullen with it."
"I've a pleasure in him," he continued, reflecting aloud. "He has satisfied my expectations. If he were born a fool, I should not enjoy it half so much. But he's no fool, and I can sympathize with all his feelings, having felt them myself. I know what he suffers now, for instance, exactly. It is merely a beginning of what he shall suffer, though. And he'll never be able to emerge from his bathos of coarseness and ignorance. I've got him faster than his scoundrel of a father secured me and lower, for he takes a pride in his brutishness. I've taught him to scorn everything extra animal, as silly and weak. Don't you think Hindley would be proud of his son, if he could see him? Almost as proud as I am of mine. But there's this difference. One is gold put to the use of paving stones, and the other is tin polished to ape a service of silver. Mine has nothing valuable about it, yet I shall have the merit of making it go as far as such poor stuff can go. His had first-rate qualities, and they are lost, rendered worse than unavailing. I have nothing to regret. He would have more than any but I are aware of. And the best of it is, Hareton is damnably fond of me. You'll own that I have outmatched Hindley there. If the dead villain could rise from his grave to abuse me for his offspring's wrongs, I should have the fun of seeing the said offspring fight him back again, indignant that he should dare to rail at the one friend he has in the world." Heathcliff chuckled a fiendish laugh at the idea. I made no reply because I saw that he expected none. Meantime, our young companion, who sat too removed from us to hear what was said, began to evince symptoms of uneasiness, probably repenting that he had denied himself the treat of Catherine's society for fear of a little fatigue. His father remarked the restless glances wandering to the window, and the hand irresolutely extended towards his cap. "Get up, you idle boy," he exclaimed with assumed heartiness. "Away after them! They are just at the corner, by the stand of hives." Linton gathered his energies and left the hearth. The lattice was open, and as he stepped out, I heard Cathy inquiring of her unsociable attendant what was the inscription over the door. Hareton stared up and scratched his head like a true clown. "It's some damnable writing," he answered. "I cannot read it."
"Can't read it?"
cried Catherine.
"I can read it. It's English.
But I want to know why it is there." Linton giggled, the first appearance of mirth he had exhibited.
"He does not know his letters," he said to his cousin. "Could you believe in the existence of such a colossal dunce?"
"Is he all as he should be?" asked Miss Cathy seriously.
"Or is he simple, not right? I've questioned him twice now, and each time he looked so stupid I think he does not understand me. I can hardly understand him, I'm sure."
Linton repeated his laugh and glanced at Hareton tauntingly, who certainly did not seem quite clear of comprehension at that moment.
"There's nothing the matter but laziness, is there, Earnshaw?" he said. "My cousin fancies you are an idiot. There you experience the consequence of scorning. Book-larning, as you would say. Have you noticed, Catherine, his frightful Yorkshire pronunciation?"
"Why, where the devil is the use in it?"
growled Hareton, more ready in answering his daily companion. He was about to enlarge further, but the two youngsters broke into a noisy fit of merriment, my giddy miss being delighted to discover that she might turn his strange talk to matter of amusement.
"Where is the use of the devil in that sentence?" tittered Linton. "Papa told you not to say any bad words, and you can't open your mouth without one. Do try to behave like a gentleman, now do."
If thou weren't more a lass than a lad, I'd fell thee this minute. I would. Pitiful lath of a creature, retorted the angry boar, retreating, while his face burnt with mingled rage and mortification. For he was conscious of being insulted, and embarrassed how to resent it. Mr. Heathcliff, having overheard the conversation as well as I, smiled when he saw him go, but immediately afterwards cast a look of singular aversion on the flippant pair, who remained chattering in the doorway, the boy finding animation enough while discussing Hareton's faults and deficiencies, and relating anecdotes of his goings-on, and the girl relishing his pert and spiteful sayings, without considering the ill nature they evinced. I began to dislike more than to compassionate Linton, and to excuse his father in some measure for holding him cheap. We stayed till afternoon. I could not tear Miss Cathy away sooner, but happily my master had not quitted his apartment and remained ignorant of our prolonged absence. As we walked home, I would fain have enlightened my charge on the characters of the people we had quitted, but she got it into her head that I was prejudiced against them.
"Aha!" she cried.
"You take Papa's side, Ellen. You are partial, I know, or else you wouldn't have cheated me so many years into the notion that Linton lived a long way from here. I'm really extremely angry. Only I'm so pleased I can't show it. But you must hold your tongue about my uncle. He's my uncle, remember, and I'll scold Papa for quarrelling with him." And so she ran on till I relinquished the endeavour to convince her of her mistake. She did not mention the visit that night, because she did not see Mr. Linton. Next day it all came out, sadly to my chagrin, and still I was not altogether sorry. I thought the burden of directing and warning would be more efficiently borne by him than me. But he was too timid in giving satisfactory reasons for his wish that she should shun connection with the household of the Heights, and Catherine liked good reasons for every restraint that harassed her petted will.
"Papa!" she exclaimed after the morning salutations. "Guess whom I saw yesterday on my walk on the moors?" "Ah, Papa, you started. You've not done right, have you now?" "I saw... But listen, and you shall hear how I found you out. And Ellen, who is in league with you and yet pretended to pity me so when I kept hoping and was always disappointed about Linton's coming back." She gave a faithful account of her excursion and its consequences, and my master, though he cast more than one reproachful look at me, said nothing till she had concluded. Then he drew her to him and asked if she knew why he had concealed Linton's near neighbourhood from her. Could she think it was to deny her a pleasure that she might harmlessly enjoy? "It was because you disliked Mr. Heathcliff," she answered. "Then you believe I care more for my own feelings than yours, Cathy?" he said. "No, it was not because I disliked Mr. Heathcliff, but because Mr. Heathcliff dislikes me, and is a most diabolical man, delighting to wrong and ruin those he hates if they give him the slightest opportunity. I knew that you could not keep up an acquaintance with your cousin without being brought into contact with him, and I knew he would detest you on my account. So for your own good and nothing else, I took precautions that you should not see Linton again. I meant to explain this some time as you grew older, and I'm sorry I delayed it."
"But Mr. Heathcliff was quite cordial, Papa," observed Catherine, not at all convinced. "And he didn't object to our seeing each other. He said I might come to his house when I pleased, only I must not tell you because you had quarrelled with him and would not forgive him for marrying Aunt Isabella." "And you won't. You are the one to be blamed. He is willing to let us be friends, at least, Linton and I, and you are not." My master, perceiving that she would not take his word for her uncle-in-law's evil disposition, gave a hasty sketch of his conduct to Isabella, and the manner in which Wuthering Heights became his property. He could not bear to discourse long upon the topic, for though he spoke little of it, he still felt the same horror and detestation of his ancient enemy that had occupied his heart ever since Mrs. Linton's death.
"She might have been living yet if it had not been for him,"
was his constant bitter reflection, and in his eyes Heathcliff seemed a murderer.
Miss Cathy, conversant with no bad deeds except her own slight acts of disobedience, injustice and passion, arising from hot temper and thoughtlessness, and repented of on the day they were committed, was amazed at the blackness of spirit that could brood on and cover revenge for years, and deliberately prosecute its plans without a visitation of remorse. She appeared so deeply impressed and shocked at this new view of human nature, excluded from all her studies and all her ideas till now, that Mr. Edgar deemed it unnecessary to pursue the subject. He merely added, "You will know hereafter, darling, why I wish you to avoid his house and family. Now return to your old employments and amusements, and think no more about them." Catherine kissed her father, and sat down quietly to her lessons for a couple of hours according to custom. Then she accompanied him into the grounds, and the whole day passed as usual. But in the evening, when she had retired to her room, and I went to help her undress, I found her crying on her knees by the bedside. "Oh, fie, silly child," I exclaimed. "If you had any real griefs, you'd be ashamed to waste a tear on this little contrariety. You never had one shadow of substantial sorrow, Miss Catherine. Suppose for a minute that Master and I were dead, and you were by yourself in the world, how would you feel then? Compare the present occasion with such an affliction as that, and be thankful for the friends you have, instead of coveting more."
"I'm not crying for myself, Ellen," she answered. "It's for him. He expected to see me again tomorrow, and though he'll be so disappointed, and he'll wait for me, and I shan't come."
"Nonsense," said I. "Do you imagine he has thought as much of you as you have of him? Hasn't he Hareton for a companion? Not one in 100 would weep at losing a relation they had just seen twice for 2 afternoons. Linton will conjecture how it is, and trouble himself no further about you."
"But may I not write a note to tell him why I cannot come?" she asked, rising to her feet. "And just send those books I promised to lend him. His books are not as nice as mine, and he wanted to have them extremely when I told him how interesting they were. May I not, Ellen?"
"No, indeed, no, indeed," replied I with decision. "Then he would write to you, and there'd never be an end of it."
"No, Miss Catherine, the acquaintance must be dropped entirely. So Papa expects, and I shall see that it is done."
"But how can one little note—" she recommenced, putting on an imploring countenance. "Silence," I interrupted.